You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hover cars, food replicators, moving sidewalks, friendly robots, jetpacks, space vacations. It's the 2016 that the creators of the Jetsons imagined. And in All Our Wrong Todays, the debut novel by award-winning screenwriter Ilan Mastai, it is the 2016 that Tom Barron knows. Despite the fact that he lives in a nearly perfect world, Tom is heartsick and miserable and inadvertently becomes a time traveler who's sent back to the year 1965. The book is published by Dutton, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ilan Mastai to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're so used to reading novels about a dystopian future. Why did you decide to set your book in a nearly perfect future, or should I say perfect present? Last year.
Yeah, well, I have always been interested, since I was a kid, in this idea of the future we were supposed to have. My grandfather, who was a chemist, he's from New York, he's from Queens. He had this extensive collection of vintage sci-fi from the 50s and 60s, and as a kid, I loved looking at, reading the stories, looking at the covers, these kind of garishly painted images of, you know, all the things you talked about, moon bases and futuristic cities and flying cars. But even in the 80s, I was aware that the future wasn't turning out the way these writers and artists imagined. And so that really stuck with me. The other thing is I grew up in Vancouver in Canada, and in 1986, we had Expo 86. And that was, you know, it's a World's Fair, like in the long continuity of World's Fairs, like the New York Fair of 64 and Expo 67, these sort of techno-utopian visions of the future.
The world of the future displays,
that's right.
Exhibits.
It absolutely captured my imagination. It's only recently that I discovered that Expo 86 was actually the last World's Fair ever hosted in North America. We kind of stopped throwing World's Fairs. We stopped imagining the future in that way. And that really interested me. Now, in the story, what ends up happening after this sort of like ill-fated trip to 1965, my protagonist, Tom, he accidentally changes the timeline. And when he returns to 2016, to the present, it's our 2016, what we think of as the real world, which to him appears to be this terrifying dystopia where everything's gone wrong. This isn't the way the world is supposed to be. And so I was enjoying playing with that idea of this utopian version of the world that the post-war generation imagined, and then what would happen if somebody from there showed up here, what it would look like to them.
Your chapters are relatively short, 2 to 3 pages. Something that grows out of your screenwriting?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you say that, because when I was writing it, I don't think I thought of it that way. But as a screenwriter, you know, I'm used to short scenes, keeping the pacing always going. And so I think I unconsciously brought that. At the same time, like a lot of first-time novelists, I had a day job. You know, I wrote this book on the side until I was able to sell it. And so in a lot of cases, those short chapters reflected just sort of like one little day's work. And I love the aesthetic of it.
Although I've spoken to other people who've done both, and they said the big difference is when you write a screenplay, more of the page has to be, doesn't have type on it. But when you're writing a book, most of the page is covered with words.
Yeah, it's true. When you're a screenwriter, you actually, one of the weird sort of side effects of the job is you learn to use white space on the page to create a sense of pacing for the reader. That was different in the book, obviously. But I found I did the same thing, knowing when to break a chapter, even knowing, okay, what's going to be on the back on a page, and then what am I going to put on the page you turn? I like to think about that experience for the reader.
Your protagonist, Tom Barron, makes a reference to Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle early on in the novel. I'm assuming Vonnegut was an inspiration.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was a major inspiration for me growing up. I think not just my worldview, but making me want to be a writer. I think he was the first novelist where he made himself as an author part of the story he was telling, and rather than detracting, it actually enhanced the experience. And so I think that he was the first writer who made me aware that that was a job you could have and one that I wanted to do.
But you haven't made yourself part of this, although Tom says that Vonnegut's writing is different where I come from.
Yeah, well, I imagine the idea that there's a key character in the book for whom Vonnegut was his favorite writer and very influential. In this alternate timeline, it's not just that the technology is different and society is different. Entertainment's different. Literature is different. Vonnegut was somebody, like a lot of writers, who responded to social change that was going around him. He would have written different books in this other reality. And so I like to think about that. And for him, in this other reality, Vonnegut was seen more as a philosopher than a novelist.
And he's a favorite of that man, Lionel Gertreider.
That's right.
Who's he?
Well, he plays a key figure in the book, in the sort of the world of the alternate this alternate version of the present. In 1965, he invents this revolutionary form of unlimited clean energy. And that's what really liberates human ingenuity in this version of the world to create all this dazzling technology. Because I was thinking about, like, what did happen to that version of the future. And a lot of the time, I came back to fuel. You know, when we're stuck with fossil fuels, even the sort of like renewables that we have, they don't produce enough energy. And so I thought about if that had been different, if in 1965 we'd had this unlimited form of clean energy, what we could have accomplished.
Tom works as a chrononaut.
Yeah.
But it's not a job that's he's very passionate about. What does he do?
Well, I was interested in writing about a character who lives in this extraordinary version of the world, but he himself is quite ordinary. He'd be the first to admit it. So yeah, he works for his father, and part of his challenge as a character is his father is this very successful scientist, and he's developing time travel. You know, he's built a prototype time machine, and Tom works for him not because he's this incredible scientist, but really more out of pity because he's so lost. I wanted to imagine a world where most of humanity's problems were solved, but it actually can sometimes make it harder for people to find their place. They don't have a sense of purpose because everything's done for them. And I wanted to contrast that with the messy version of the world we live in now, where we all have to take responsibility for action. So he works for his father developing this time machine, and of course, that's where things start to go awry.
He decides to activate the time machine without his father's permission.
Yes, he's heartbroken, he's grief-stricken, he's in a bad place after a tragedy happens in his life, but he makes a very ill-considered decision to steal a time machine.
You go into great detail about the workings and consequences of time travel. Did you have to do historical research for this book and also study quantum mechanics, the concept of wormholes or Einstein-Rosen bridges?
I did. My grandfather, as I said, was a scientist and a chemist, and one of his big complaints, he loved science fiction, but he was always complaining that they didn't take the time to actually figure out the science. And in fact, if you spend the time to figure out the science, you can make the story more interesting. And I took that on me. I don't want to overburden the reader with all the research I did, so I only included the aspects of orbital mechanics or quantum physics that I felt filled the story. But yeah, I did a lot of research on it.
But even now, physicists argue over whether the time travel is possible and whether, if it were possible, we would go back in time 1 hour for each real hour, or whether we could suddenly just go into a wormhole and be swept away to 1965. And if we were, would the wormhole disappear and prevent us from coming back to the current time?
What's fun about this stuff, of course, is once you start to kind of like explore the actual implications where the science is now, and of course the science is provisional, we're still figuring it out. It actually, I find these questions of time and time travel end up telling us a lot about human regret, about memory. You know, time travel stories are usually stories about regret, about the desire to have a second chance. And so, I mean, you know, we are all stuck inside time, and it's this great dream to be able to kind of like move around in it. And I find when you start exploring the implications, not just, you know, the technical implications, time machines and alternate realities, but the emotional implications of time, I think you start to get at the heart of what makes us human.
My guest is Ilan Mastai. His book, his novel, All Our Wrong Todays, it is published by Dutton. You've actually covered both of the time travel concepts because you have traveled back into the past, but also in a way the future that people often travel to. You've said that your book asks the question, what happened to the future we were supposed to have, or what do we mean when we talk about the future we think we deserve? Do you think that people tended to idealize the future 50 years ago?
Yeah, I do. I think that there was more of a honeyed kind of optimistic sense that technology was going to solve all our problems, you know? And I think that that is evolved. I think our awareness of the consequences of our actions on the planet, the implications of, you know, the explosion in the human population has changed our sense of how much we can actually control. So I think the reason I chose 1965 as that sort of hinge moment in history, because it felt like the time when that sort of the optimism of the post-war generation started to curdle, and not quickly, but over time there was a sense that we started to shift into more of a dystopian or at least cynical sense, a skeptical sense of where we were going.
Kennedy had been assassinated. We were slipping into the war in Vietnam.
That's
I don't know what it was like in Canada where you were growing up, but Canada is close enough to the United States for you to be aware of everything that's happening.
Absolutely. And, my grandfather and my grandmother were American. My mother was born in Chicago. So, even when I was growing up in Vancouver, I was very aware of sort of what was happening in the U.S. And Canada tends to be kind of pulled into all of that as well.
How did you begin your career as a screenwriter? A review in the Wall Street Journal said that you, quote, toiled without a hit movie for 15 years. Was it really all that difficult? Was it because you were working in Canada?
I appreciated the piece in the Wall Street Journal, and the journalist was lovely. I think she had a story to tell. I mean, I'm actually incredibly privileged. I mean, I have worked at both independent, but I've worked in the Hollywood studio system for many years, working for all kinds of studios. And I've been very fortunate to make a great living as a screenwriter for a number of years. At the same time, as much as I do love the collaborative process of filmmaking, I did find myself feeling a little restricted by the limitations of the form. Screenplays are written in a very specific way. Even though you're writing different genres, it's the same writing style. It's always the third person. It's always the present tense. It's a very laconic, very lean
form. You have to
have
three acts.
Exactly. You're always external to the character. And so, as much as I enjoy writing movies, and it's been a privilege to be able to do that, I, as a writer, I was looking for the next challenge. And when I came up with the idea for this story, the ability to write it as a book, to have the first-person perspective of the character, and to kind of take the reader on this journey through the words, not images projected onto a screen, was really exciting.
Well, you did have a breakthrough film in 2013, The F Word, or What If in the United States, which starred Daniel Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan, and won the Canadian Screen Award for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yeah.
I would have thought that would have sent you off writing lots of romantic comedies.
It did, and it opened up a tremendous number of doors and winning the awards and stuff like that. And the movie was quite a sizable success story, particularly in Canada. At the same time, look, as I said, I really enjoy writing movies, but in the Hollywood system, they will only ever reward you for repeating yourself. I mean, and I don't blame them. Movies are very expensive, but essentially you get offered the same thing over and over again. And as a writer, to be honest, I mean, I did write some other romantic comedies, which are sort of, working their way through the system.
And this is a romantic comedy.
Well, it is. I mean, there's a big romance and there's a lot of comedy. It's not really hard sci-fi. It's actually very much, there's some science fiction ideas behind it, but most of the book takes place in our world, and it's very much about the relationship and these characters. And I just felt like I had more to say than just writing another romantic comedy.
Why does he fall for Penelope? She seems to be very different.
Well, I think at first that, there's two different versions, not to give too much away in the plot, but he meets two very different versions of Penelope, or Penny, as he calls her in our version of the world. I think at first he's somebody who hasn't found his place, who feels like he'll never succeed because his father has been so successful. And when he meets Penelope, she's so capable and focused and driven, and it's kind of mesmerizing for him. When he meets the other version of her, she's a much more open, loose, kind of casual person. She's sort of trying to figure herself out too. And so he kind of has these two. I think in one version of the world, he kind of admires her. But the other version, he finds a much more honest, direct connection. And really, what I always thought the book was about is somebody who's learning to live a more authentic and honest life.
Can you escape from the movies? As I understand it, soon after you got the book deal with Dutton, Paramount Pictures bought the film rights.
Yes. I mean,
are you going to be able to write your own screenplay?
Yeah, I'm working on that right now, actually. I am. As soon as Dutton acquired the book, we sold the rights to Paramount, and Amy Pascal is producing it. So, no, I went from trying to challenge myself with a novel. Suddenly, I just got sucked right back into the movie business.
But I suspect this has given you a taste for writing novels.
Oh, absolutely. I love it. You hope that the book connects with readers and you get more opportunities to bring books into the world. Because, I mean, I've always been somebody who loves books. I'm the kind of person, I travel everywhere with a paperback in my back pocket. And I love the opportunity to write more novels. At the same time, I mean, the chance to bring the story of the book and these characters who I fell in love with to a movie audience is exciting. Although challenging, right? Adapting your own book is no easy feat.
Because everything you leave out is kind of killing one of your children.
I did. I was saying to a friend, I felt like I was just, as I was trying to type the screenplay, I felt like I was literally just tearing pages out of the book and throwing them over my shoulder. At the same time, it forces you to think about what is this story about at its essence.
Although they often say that the best things to adapt into films are short stories.
Yeah, I was thinking
about... Because you can even expand on them a little bit.
I was thinking about the Ted Chiang story, Story of Your Life, which was adapted into The Arrival, and what a terrific job they did with that. But that was a 40-page short story that they could embellish. Yeah, I'm going the opposite way. I certainly didn't make it easy on myself.
Ilan Mastai, Mastai, his first novel is All Our Wrong Todays. It is published by Dutton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard, for having me.